Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with a personal price plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey gang, it's the Nerds Podcast number 606. 606 episodes of the podcast. How did this happen? Well, I guess it's very obvious. I did 606 of them, but it still blows me away. The podcast in my head still feels new. Is that weird? Do you feel that way? Comment in the threads on the site if you do. This episode is Alex Borstein, who you may have initially seen on Mad TV, but then is also the voice of Lois on Family Guy, and has a super hilarious show called Getting On, which is currently on HBO. It is about nurses in the geriatric ward of a hospital, and they've made it funny. They've made it extremely funny, but Alex is an incredible improviser and also just super funny performer, and you should watch her. But listen to this first, and then you could watch that. I'm sure she'd be okay with me saying, like, listen to her on the podcast first, then watch Getting On. It is the Nerdist Podcast number 606 with Alex Borstein.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Ordered these couches that cost more than a vehicle, and I didn't know it didn't include the fabric.
Oh, he did. Oh, yeah, no.
He showed up to show me the fabrics, and I said, oh, I like this, 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 and this. And then I got the separate invoice and went, what?
Oh, yeah, that sucks.
I'm not fucking paying that.
No, she's been pretty cool about, she's very cool about, like, here's what everything will cost, and here's this, and here's that.
So. I guess I didn't ask the right questions. I don't know, dude, but.
They can sort of be like, you can sort of get fucked over sometimes.
Yeah, and I'm just, I can't
you
do
don't
it.
Have to.
I can do it.
Don't.
It makes me want to throw.
I'm 100% in support of this, all even right. Though my opinion carries no weight with you whatsoever.
Thank you. You have a chewy notebook.
I do have a chewy notebook.
I like your opinion.
Okay, good. What, that's all it took?
That's all it took.
I wish America was that easy.
That's all it took.
Guys, I have a chewy notebook. Okay. That's everything you say took. Is fine. How's it going?
It's going.
Yeah.
I made it here.
You did.
I'm here. I parked. There was no problem with parking.
Which is a very big deal in Los Angeles.
It really is.
It really, like, it. Parking, and most other cities don't really understand this. Parking really determines a lot of what you do in this town. This is like, oh, you want to come over? How's the parking? It's not very good. Oh, I can't.
Yeah, people are very weak in Los Angeles about parking. They really are. The Angelenos are very, they're deterred by many things. Anything will give them an excuse to not leave the house.
Weather?
Yeah.
Traffic? Parking?
Yes.
Agoraphobia. What else?
Smog alerts.
Smog alerts are very bad. Mm-hmm. Oh, the air. Really? Because mm-hmm. It's always kind of bad. So it's slightly more bad than it would otherwise be.
Yeah, I don't mind having thick, painful air.
No, it's not that bad. Mm-mm. It's not that bad at all. I mean, you know, you go outside, maybe don't run outside a whole bunch.
I don't run as a general rule.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
What if someone's chasing you?
Nope, not even then.
Really?
Yep.
You got me.
I don't.
Not...
I'm not going to do it.
Not going to do it.
Because they're going to get me anyway, and then I look stupid. Then I'm caught and slow.
Gotcha. So it's just like, why bother with the illusion?
Right. I could be caught and so cool I didn't even bother to run.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I totally appreciate that. I can't... I like running on a treadmill. Ugh. But I don't... Is that a joyful?
You're the worst.
Better than running outside.
That's the worst.
Why is that the worst?
That's habit trail.
It is.
That is the sign of someone in like neuroses.
You think so?
I do.
I just like feeling. It just makes me feel better.
It does.
Yeah, because then your heart pumps and your blood flows, and then you feel. And you sort of feel, you know.
Here's what I'll do. I will take the stairs up to my condo.
Okay. Instead of the elevator?
Yep.
How many floors?
About 3.
Okay. So it's like a walk up, basically, for you?
Just a little bit of a walk up. I'll do that. I'm willing to do that. Unless there's a kid with me. If I've got a kid with me, then we take the elevator.
Oh, okay. Do you have kids?
I do.
How many kids?
2 of them.
2 kids?
Mm-hmm.
And what's their age range?
6 and 2.
6 and 2. Oh, wow. That's a spread.
Yeah.
That's quite a spread. So the 6-year-old is kind of getting self-sufficient yet, so you can focus a little more on the 2-year-old?
Yeah, that's what I thought would happen. But what happens is then the 6-year-old is cognizant enough to be extremely jealous of the 2-year-old and to regress to the point of being more difficult than the 2-year-old.
Just to get it more attention.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sometimes.
Right. So if they were closer in age, they'd probably bond a little bit more and...
I don't know. They definitely bond, but I just feel like it's such a perfect age for manipulation that it's working against me a little bit.
And does it work? Are your kids more powerful?
Yeah, they're powerful. They're powerful. They win every time. I threaten to take things away and then forget to.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, you always want to be, I would imagine, I don't have kids, but I would imagine you want to be cool. You know, like you want to be the cool parent, but at a certain point, you know that kids will take advantage of that and push boundaries. And it's like, God damn it, I wanted to be cool, but now you're putting me in a position where I can't be cool.
And you don't want to have to – following through with the shit that you threaten is hard.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time. And I'm going to – okay, he didn't want to get dressed this morning to leave. I said, listen, if you don't stop drawing, I'm going to take those markers away. You need to get dressed. I need you to get dressed. When you don't listen to me, it makes mommy feel frustrated. Mommy needs you to get dressed. Can you get dressed for mommy? Mommy needs you to... Meanwhile, right, 10 minutes ago, I said I was going to take the markers away. It's now we're 15 minutes into the argument. I haven't taken the markers away. Then I take the markers away, and guess what? Now I got to take the markers away. And when I want him to leave me alone and color and do what he's got to do because mommy needs to get... Now I don't have the markers.
If it makes you feel any better, I was suddenly very motivated to get dressed.
Were you?
Yeah.
Aw. So. We are naked right now.
We just thought it would be spruce up the podcast. I mean, you guys can't see this listening to this audio podcast, but you can feel the energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is chilly in here.
It's very cold.
Which doesn't bode well for you.
No.
But
well, I'm seated behind a desk.
That's why. Yeah.
Yeah. I was a little embarrassed. I mean... Listen, you can make all the excuses that you want, but ultimately people are like, nah, but still.
I know.
You know.
I know.
Still down there. Where did you start at did you start at Groundlings?
I did not. I did a sketch comedy group here in LA called Acme Comedy.
Oh, you were at Acme, not Groundlings. You were at Acme.
Acme.
I know Acme very, very, very well. Oh, yeah. I used to do stand-up shows there years ago. Acme is, that's where Corolla started.
That's
and
right.
Garmin and all those guys. And then there was another, the group of people that I knew when I started doing stand-up in LA that were in Acme were the Jeff Lewis's and Jamie Kaler's of the world.
I'm very dear friends with both of them.
So Kaler I haven't seen in ages, but he used to run the Thursday night stand-up show at O'Brien's where he was a bartender.
Yes, he was.
And I did, when I used to drink, I used to go get drunk and do stand-up there on Thursday nights. And he worked as a bartender way longer than he should have, but he just made so much money.
I know.
And he had this great rent control apartment in Santa Monica.
And he was perfect for it. He's just this good looking Irish guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was perfect.
Really just a good natured, just
he
like
he is a father now.
I know he's a father now. He like moved to the valley and
it's
got
crazy,
married and had
right?
a kid. And,
it's crazy.
You know, now he's
got this great butterball baby.
Oh, that's
She's
great.
She's got this big old giant moon face. She's really cute.
He was He's funny because he was a Navy guy.
I know,
and
veteran.
Was stationed in San Diego, and didn't really start doing comedy until like late, like in his 30s.
Yeah.
But he just has these great stories about, like, I mean, when he was in the Navy, it was like there wasn't really a lot going on. So right. It was sort of like a fun time. Or maybe that's not true,
like
actually.
Frat house.
Maybe he actually went over for the first Persian Gulf War, I don't know if he was in any action.
I don't know. I don't care about him that much to actually, you know, say, when I say, how are you? Like, I don't really want
to. You don't want an answer.
Yeah.
You don't want to hear about all.
Him and I actually did one of the favorite sketches I did at Acme, him and I did, that he wrote. And it was him showing up drunk, a boyfriend showing up drunk to, I was playing his girlfriend's house. And it was just a very real scene. It was so many things there were really large and broad, you know, comedically, with wigs and ridiculous sketches. I'm an old lady at the market, you know, and he wrote this very real sketch that was very bittersweet, you know, a drunk guy showing up trying to make things right with an ex-girlfriend. And it was always one of my favorite things to do.
And so what was Acme more, was it more character centric?
Everything. Yeah, you know, you were encouraged to kind of build characters. And a lot of people, the goal was they wanted to audition for SNL or,
right.
You know, it ended up Mad TV or whatever. But everyone kind of did a little of everything. It depended on their strengths. Some people wrote news sketches, you know, it was like a news desk. Some people wrote the same character every single time. Every time they'd put up new material, it was their same kind of recurring character, whether it worked before or not.
Right. Well, and because for the longest time, Groundlings really had a stranglehold on, like, that's the sketch comedy group. I mean, I know there were a lot of sketch comedy groups in L.A., yeah. But not all of them had, like, an institution. And, you know, this was obviously pre-UCB. And Acme was really started to kind of really establish itself as a real entity. But I don't know what, I mean, I drive by it all the time. It's still, the theater's still, I mean.
It never took off. It never became, it always felt like I went from Acme, which was always compared to Groundlings, to Mad TV, which was always compared to SNL. Like, always in the shadow of something. And it never exploded or took off. And a lot of people came from Acme, especially that went into writing. A lot of people and radio. And but yeah, it just never blossomed the same way. I mean, maybe there's just room for one institution, kind of like Groundlings. I know a lot of people that went to Acme went because they were fed up with Groundlings.
Right.
I had no experience with Groundlings. I'd never been there, but I heard from people that it was like the other actors vote you in or out of groups, and people felt like it was just very political, and
right.
Women felt upset they couldn't get ahead because other women were, which I don't know, but because I never experienced it, but I did like Acme and that my brother and I signed up at the same time to take classes, and I liked that there was one dude who ran it. Whether you agreed with him or not, it was just his call. Whether a sketch got in or you got in, or it was just simple. It was clean, and you know, I got to immediately perform. I took one improv class and then I auditioned for the troupe, and I got in not the main company, but the next.
Mm-hmm.
And just immediately got to write material and put it up on stage. So it wasn't like months or years of classes.
It was a good space, too. I really liked the space. And,
yeah.
And so there would, I would do stand-up shows there every once in a while. Or like J. Keith Van Stratton would do his talk show there. And
yep.
They'd go do stand-up on that. And then,
yeah.
And then up above Farfalla next door was, you know,
F2.
Like F2 or, you know, room. It used to be called Room 5 or something.
Uh-huh.
And then,
that's right.
So there were like there were stand-up shows up there, too. So it was like, It started to really kind of pop. It's like, oh, downstairs at Acme, and then upstairs you could do shows up here. But then, I don't know. I just don't know what happened. I mean,
and then
I haven't.
Carolla and Sweeney, the guy who ran Acme for years, that they invested in Farfalla. They bought that restaurant, and it was called Amalfi.
Yeah, Amalfi. Is
they
it
might
still there?
Still, they
I think
might
it might still,
still own
be Amalfi.
It. Yeah,
does Evan still have that restaurant?
Yeah,
I think so.
Really?
Yeah, he's doing podcasts there every Wednesday for a while.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, Adam. Carolla's one of those guys who's just like the secret billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to his house. I've known Adam for 15, no more, like 20 years. And maybe like 5 years ago, I went to his house and I knew he was doing well, but he just had like, it's like his car collection is like, where,
Yeah.
Where do you get the money for a fucking DB9 yeah. and next to like a 1968 Ferrari? And those are just the ones that are not in your shop.
But isn't that
cool? And you have a shop.
But isn't that cool? Someone that's just quietly.
Yes, it's amazing.
Just quietly collecting money and going about his business and creating. I mean, you know, what he did with his podcast is pretty huge. And you creating
never,
his own way.
You would never know. I mean, like, and if you know, I mean, if you listen to the podcast now, if you listen to Adam now, you probably have an understanding. But for the longest time, when Adam was just sort of like, man, I'm just that guy. That no people didn't understand that he has exquisite taste. Like mm-hmm. if you see, because he redoes, you know, like he would just redo his own houses.
Yeah,
and they were gorgeous. And I always thought that was such an interesting disparity between the guy that people, you know, like
that's his shtick.
It
know?
Is the shtick,
right?
It is. But he used to. I mean, when I first started working at K Rock, he was just calling in and doing characters because mm-hmm. Kimmel was like, "Here's the number, call
yeah.
in." But I mean, even though. So going back to what you said, you know, even though Acme may not have become an institution, it a lot of people who went on to do things.
Yeah, I learned so much there. I mean, it really helped me write. At the time, I was working in advertising when I was started at Acme, and I was a copywriter. So that really helped too. That was kind of like copywriting was Twitter for me at the time. It uh-huh. was like having to be succinct. You only have so many characters, one line in a print ad. You want to try to sell something. What's the best way to write this? And so it was really great training for comedy writing, you know, because that's what comedy writing is being really quick, really succinct.
It's like it's like advertising.
And you're trying to persuade the audience yes. to feel a certain way. So it was really great training. And then Acme kind of continued that. And then it was putting it up in front of people. You know, in advertising, I'd get frustrated. Oh, client didn't like my line. No one bought my headlines. No one liked my things. That's funny. They don't know what they're talking about. Well, at Acme, I would get up on stage and find out, oh no, I don't know what I'm talking about. That was not good. That was not funny. And here's why. And so it was the best training you could kind of get.
Was Steve Callahan at Acme?
Yes.
You know, Steve Callahan was my orientation counselor at UCLA.
Oh my goodness.
And I was in a stand-up comedy club at UCLA, and Steve was the president, and I worshipped him because at orientation, he was the funniest counselor.
Uh-huh.
And he was the person that sort of when I had always kind of wanted to do stand-up, like he was my gateway. And he was president of this stand-up comedy group.
He was your gateway drug?
He was my gateway drug. And I've known Steve since I was 17 years old. And so...
Yeah. I haven't known him that long, but I've known him for about 20 years.
And Steve, just for people who may or may not know, he's ascended the ranks on Family Guy. Like,
yeah, he's one of the showrunners.
He's one of the showrunners now. And he was, you know... I remember when he started writing on that show... You know, I mean, he's been on the show since...
He started as a writer's assistant.
Right.
I knew him from Acme. I had done the show. I did the pilot presentation for Family Guy, recorded it. And then after Fox said, we're picking this show up, they said, are we sure about these voices? Let's make sure. And then Seth had to re-audition like every woman on the planet. And I almost lost the game. Like he had to do his... You know, they wanted to make sure. Are you sure these are... So that he... auditioned everyone in the universe and then came into the room at Family Guy with a tape recorder and played these two voices. And Steve Callahan was one of the writer's assistants at the time in the room and heard it. And he knew immediately that it was my voice and had to shut up, you know, kind of back down. No one wanted his opinion anyway, but, you know, Seth kind of rooted for me and I won the job.
Well, that's so good.
But yeah, Steve.
He's such a good guy.
We've known each other for a long time.
He had this bit that I remember from college where it was something about like a town crier, but in ancient Egypt. Mm. And he comes out and reads this scroll and goes, "Fish, fish, man with a cane and a craned neck. I don't know. That looks like a jackal." Like he basically right. was just like doing hieroglyphics. And so if you the next time you see Steve, if you say "fish, fish, man with a cane and a craned neck," it'll warp his brain.
Much changed at Acme. He did very similar pieces.
Yeah,
we did this one bit together that was Smitty's Believe It or Don't, and it was just like a. Nonverbal bit because he's about 7 feet tall.
He's very tall, yes.
I'm 5 feet tall. And we just did this bit as though we were circus freaks And it was just music and a drum roll. And he would stand there and put his arms out, and I would just walk under his arms. Go, ta-da! This huge finish. And I'd walk under his legs. Ta-da! And it was just comparing his great height and my minuscule height.
So at this point, are you I assume it's super efficient, or you just go in, read, go home.
At Family Guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty efficient. You know, I mean, I know the character inside and out, so there's never really a question about how I'm going to deliver something. I mean, there's times Steve is in the room directing and in the booth. There's some times where he says, oh, you know, when we pitched this, because when I used to write on the show, there was no question because I was in the writer's room. I knew exactly the intention. But sometimes if I can't make it to a table read and then I get in the booth, sometimes I'll get something wrong. I'm like, oh, no, the intention was, and they'll let me know. But for the most part, it's pretty efficient.
How long did you write on the show?
Oh, a long time. I mean, the whole first, you know, we were on the air, and then, what was that, 98-ish, I was writing on the show way back in the beginning. Then we got canceled. Then we came back in April of 2004.
Are you shitting me? That show's been on that long? Mm-hmm. It's like 16 years?
Yeah. Oh, well, our shows take 9 months to make, so we were working on them in 97, 98. I think it aired 99. So
it's still a long time.
It's still a long time.
That's still fucking. That's still the 1900s.
I know. Here's how long we've been on the air. When we were first recording, Mila Kunis had to be driven to and from because she didn't have a driver's license.
And now she's got her own baby.
She had her learner's permit. She was 15 and a half.
Oh my God.
Isn't that crazy? And now she's got a baby sucking off her teat.
She does.
Yeah.
Do you have pictures of that?
Yes.
Okay, great.
I do. Mm-hmm. I'll show
Everything
you
seems in order. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there they are. Does it, I'm always curious when you have a recurring character on a sketch show, as you did, that is a big hit character and you do it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Is there at what point are you like, you don't really want to, but they're like, but you gotta.
You know what? It wasn't that I ever didn't want to do the Miss Swan character. It was that, oh my God, there are four other sketches that me and these other writers came up with that is so funny. Can we do this? And when it came time for them to choose, if they only had one slot, they'd always want the recurring character.
So of course.
You were bummed because you always want to do something new. You want to do the next exciting, fresh thing. You know, it's that was the hardest time I had doing stand-up. Why I never really did a lot of it was I couldn't stand repeating the same material too often. It was hard. It was just brutal for me to hear my own voice saying the same words again.
That's funny. It's like, well, when a lot of people start doing stand-up, they're like, I'm never going to repeat the same joke again. And you go, well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Because part of the stand-up process is honing and whittling and honing and whittling as opposed to, you know, I mean, it's certainly, I don't know what the turnover rate for sketches was at Acme, but it's a high turnover rate.
Yeah.
You're just fucking.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, rifling through as much as possible.
It's so much work. And, but anyway, that was how I felt with some of the, but you know, the recurring swans that we did, I mean, I really had a blast doing them, and we started doing some weird, surreal stuff with her and we did like this one connected storyline one season and had Dennis Hopper and Susan Sarandon in as guest stars and Tony Shalhoub. It was just so random and weird and wonderful.
Do you miss doing sketch?
You know, ever since doing Mad TV, like I can't even watch sketch anymore. I don't know why. I got so burnt out. The thing I miss is the immediacy of Acme or Mad TV where you come up with something that week. Something's pertinent right then and there and you have a really fun idea and you get to do it and you just put it up. All of a sudden you pitch it, you write it. There's a set built, there are costumes made and there you are doing this weird random idea you had or some other brilliant writer on the staff had. Or I miss that, the immediacy of it. Now I'm in a world of like doing a lot of TV development or writing feature films that never get made.
Right.
Never happen. There's 2 years of developing something before it's finally said, like, oh, it's not going anywhere. So it's,
you haven't heard anything about that thing for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. So I missed that. That was really fun, the immediacy of it.
Yeah, the film, that script, that whole script writing.
You know, we're recording this. You don't have to take notes.
No, I make him write everything down word for word.
All right,
it keeps him on his toes.
It's interesting.
It's like that script writing business where you can just sell a bunch of scripts, and then none of them ever get made. It's almost like the script almost becomes like a weird cousin that you had where you're like, I haven't seen that guy in ages. And like, I think he might be dead. I don't know, you know.
And it's heartbreaking. I'll pick something up after, you know, from 3 years ago and, oh, I don't remember this piece of shit. And then you read it and say, wait, this is actually really funny. There's really great stuff in here.
Nothing's ever going to happen with it.
That was like a year of work and it's just sitting there.
And the film companies can get really, they just get like weirdly territorial about stuff. And you're like, can I do something with this? No. Well, yeah. How come? Well, it's ours. Yeah, I know, but you're not going to do anything with it. Well, we could. Are you? No.
Yeah.
But.
Or you have to pay to get it back.
Right.
You know, or I remember one time, similarly, I was like under contract, was doing this pilot. It was dead. It was not going anywhere. And someone wanted me to audition for something else coming up. You know what? It was a Louis C.K. project. It was when he was doing a network pilot.
I auditioned for that pilot.
Yes.
I know exactly. Bruce, the showrunner from Drew Carey was showrunning that. I remember that pilot. It was
a couple years.
It was like 2004 or 5 maybe. It was a while ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago. And I was, you know, called. Oh, do you want to audition for this? I said, yeah. And then someone said, oh, you know, I don't know if you can because you're technically still under contract for that pilot. Oh, but it's dead. It's not. You technically can't. We can't even have you into audition if you're not out of. Well, okay. Let me call the producer on that and see if it's cool. Yeah, I want to audition for this thing. Oh, okay. Well, you're still under contract, so if you want to, technically, we bought you out for this amount. If you want to audition for that, you need to pay us back. So I had to pay back $60,000 of my contract for this thing to audition. And the audition went nowhere.
Oh, God damn it.
So I was out $60,000 to
that
audition.
That sucks.
Isn't that terrible?
I had the same exact thing happen where I had done a sitcom in like 98. And then the studio was like, well, it was one of the famous holding deals of the 90s. We were like, we want to put you in a holding deal. And it sounds like a lot of money at once, but then you realize like, oh, it's really not that much because you can't work for a year.
They hold you for 30 years.
They hold you, yeah. And then after taxes, when you get a lump sum of money and then commissions and everything, it's really not that, it's genuinely not that much money at all. And so the deal hadn't been closed yet, and I was going to test for Jake Johansson had a pilot. He had a pilot every year for a while, and I was supposed to test for it, and I thought I had a really good shot, and they were like, oh, well, you can't test because this other holding deal is going to happen. I'm like, but it's not signed yet. And he's like, yeah, but they don't want to. And so finally, they were like, well, we'll try to get you out of it. So the test came and went. And then afterwards they were like, okay, we got you out of the thing. I'm like, yeah, but now I can't. Now it's so like, oh yeah, well now it's too late. So yeah, I lost both of them.
It's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, it is.
But that's why when you do get a gig, the pay seems, oh God, you make so much money in this business, but it's because you've spent 20 years dealing with nothing happening, nothing selling, getting kicked around that way.
It's back pay.
It really is. It's kind of making up for all that.
I'm kind of glad that, well, let me ask you, I don't know how many, when you look back at the path, were there a lot of, I don't want to call them failures, but just failed pilots, failed shows, failed things along the way?
Yeah. I don't think I have as many as a lot of people. A lot of people are like the pilot king and queen. You know, people do every year they're cast in pilots. And I had one that I wrote and developed. It was the first one. I co-wrote it with Maya Forbes. It was called Life at 5 Feet. And, you know, it was just as good as anything else that they were making. I'm not saying, oh, it was so great, but it came out fine and was pretty good. And we came really close. And then they said, oh, I think we want to reshoot the pilot. We want to do it for mid season. So we had to fire people and then recast it and then getting ready to reshoot it. And then all of a sudden they pulled the plug. Nothing happened. And like, they went as far as to fly us to New York to, they were going to announce a mid. So that was one, that was kind of the big first after post Mad TV, I think. That was what I did, that pilot. That was 2002.
Yeah,
and it failed. And then I did this other pilot once called The Thick of It. That was a British import. Yeah. I think now Veep is kind of, it's Armando Iannucci. It's kind of
the same baby. The thick of it was Peter Capaldi, who is now the Doctor. Like, he's the new on Doctor Who. Like, mm-hmm. The thick of it was a huge British show.
Yeah.
But it's also...
And they tried to do one here in the U.S., and it was Mitch Hurwitz wrote it, and Christopher Guest directed it.
Wow.
It was really exciting. Cast was really cool, and it just didn't go. God, one of those shockers.
Hope someone posts that somewhere.
It'll be fun.
I wish that Netflix or someone would just acquire a bunch of failed pilots.
The pilot channel.
Because there must be... I guarantee you, I mean, obviously there's a lot of obvious stinkers out there, but there's probably some really fucking good shows that just...
Oh, but don't you want to see the stinkers?
Yes, I want to see both.
I'm dying to see that.
The stinkers will be fun, and the good shows will be heartbreaking, because you're like, that didn't... Because you know that there's... It didn't test well with some weird demographic in a Vegas mall.
Right.
Or that they... Or it was some political reason, like, oh, the executive didn't want this because he had... You know, it's like... There's a lot of stuff gets snuffed out the way, like, if a new lion comes in a pride and basically just like smother, like just like chokes out all of the cubs that aren't his. That's exactly what happens in the television business.
Exactly, and it's just as bloody.
It's very bloody.
Just as bloody.
Yeah, it's pretty. I mean, it's not surprising that performers can turn out to be real. You can get real fucked up from all of the like stopping and the starting and the never feeling stable.
And the hopefulness, you know, you go in to do a test for an audition and you have to sign the contract as though the gig is yours.
And so you see
so
all the
deal points. You're signing this for 5 years. Oh, look at how much I'm going to be making. Look at year five. I'm a millionaire in year five. And then it doesn't even matter. They chose none of you from the audition.
They just offered it to someone that, you know.
Oh, we went with Selma Blair.
Yeah.
What? All right.
Yeah, we just gave it to her. Well, you know, the fucked up thing about the business, too, is that because of guild rules, they have to audition a certain number of people, maybe, even if they intend to offer it to someone anyway. So
oh, interesting.
I think they can... I'm pretty sure this is true, that if they...
So we are paying the Screen Actors Guild dues. We're paying them to yank us around.
In a way.
Here are my dues. Make me show up somewhere for no fucking reason.
I can't prove that this is the case. It's something I heard once. So if this is not true... But it's one of the reasons why... The reason that I'd heard that is because someone said, oh, well, they want to offer you this thing, but they can't because they have to audition a certain number of people first. And then I ended up not getting it. Every time they tell you, like, this part is yours, it's not ever yours.
And they're looking for an Alex Borstein type,
they
but
could
not
just
Alex
have
Borstein.
The original one.
Yeah.
Why would you want the type?
I don't know.
But you're on a show now that is...
I am.
That people are liking a lot, so that must be nice.
You know, it's really nice. It's not even just that people are liking. I mean, I'm so lucky to have that experience with Family Guy, but... This is like a dream. This is what you kind of think only happens to other people, that you're playing this character that is really fun, really flawed, really messed up, really rich. And it's especially rare, like with female characters. It's just the coolest. You know, at my age, you just start going like, okay, I'm going to be a mom on a sitcom, or I'll be on the Disney Channel and I'll have a kid with magic powers or something. I don't know what the fuck. But kid that fucking farts gold or something. I don't fucking know, but
gold shards.
Yeah. I was so happy to have something that's just still, I'm kind of still playing a kid myself, which is rare.
I'm sorry, I'm going back to the gold charts, which is the name of the family.
Should we pitch it?
Yeah. The gold charts.
They're Jewish.
And the one kid shits out gold.
And being Jewish, they're happy about it.
I mean, I don't know what the circumstances are, but I feel like the kid can't just shit out gold at will. Like,
well, it's based on the Golden Goose,
right?
By Hans Christian Andersen.
That's right.
So
it's a reframing
have to pay royalties
of that.
On that.
Yeah, it's a reboot of that story.
It is
where the goose is now a small child.
That's right. Mom and Dad love the child, but Grandma wants to cut the fucker open. And just go straight to the nuggets. I'm writing this tomorrow.
This is the gold charts. It definitely or at the very least, it could be a flashback in a Family Guy episode.
This is true.
I mean, that's might be a tough pitch of the Disney Channel.
I don't know.
You don't think so?
I don't know. All those kids, the Disney Channel, what's so funny to me is they spend all this time trying to make this wholesome, kid-friendly stuff, and then, you know, the day those kids wrap their first thing, they, like, take their clothes off and pose in Maxim, and...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They all just become, like, filthy whores the next day. So this would just be speeding that along.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's basically, it's not just diving in. It's just like you're easing people into that process.
We're just...
What a fucked up life. I mean, like, what a fucked up thing to have to... For a kid who's so struggling with their identity that they have to be like, oh, I have to let everyone know I'm an adult now by showing them my adult tits.
My adult parts.
My adult parts.
You think I'm a kid? Does a kid have these?
Yes, you start getting those at like 14. Kinda. You're still a kid. Yes.
Yeah, it is something.
Are you ever going to let your kids in the entertainment business before they're old enough to make their own decision?
You know, that's the thing is like I did school plays and I went to like a summer camp that had theater stuff in it, like here in Southern California. I would always encourage that if they're into it. I would never like make them do it. But no, in terms of like getting an agent before they were 18,
driving around to auditions and shit.
No, I really wanted to be performing when I was younger. My mother kind of didn't want to push me into that direction, kind of thought it was a little bit gross. But there was this one audition we heard about that was coming to town. It was called Kids of the Century.
What?
That's right.
What?
And I was like, Mom, when is this ever going to happen again? It's a whole century. And so she let me go on this audition. And I went on it and you had to like dance. They taught you a choreographed number. So I was wearing like these plasticky dance pants. It looks like when you're heavy in the 50s, they put you in plastic gear so you sweat. And you had to learn a dance combination and you had to sing a little song and do a monologue. And you went from room to room as they did these little activities. And I remember I did the monologue, did the dance. I was like, yeah, man, I got this. And I went up to the piano when they were doing the singing part and I could see they had my sheet of paper up on the board on the piano bench. And I was like trying to sneak a peek and she kept jotting down notes as I was singing and doing it. She walked away for a second and I leaned in and read the writing. And I was like, oh. It said, funny, has weight problem, tone deaf.
Oh, my God.
It was insane.
How old are you at this point?
I must have been about 13.
So the most impressionable you can be about yourself.
Crushing. Yeah, it was like the worst thing ever.
Oh, my God.
Nothing came of it. And all I got out of it was like, I'm funny, I have a weight problem, and I'm tone deaf, which stuck with me for...
Oh, my God. So just like you're shutting your eyes
at
night.
For the next 20 years.
Just seeing that red lettering.
Hilarious.
God damn it.
Hilarious.
I mean, but, you know, if anything about that kicked you into comedy, does that...
Yeah. I mean, I was like, all right, well, she says I can't sing. If I'm fat, I guess I can't dance. I guess it's comedy. That's all we got left.
Oh, God damn it. That's so terrible.
Isn't that great?
What is a kid of the century, by the way?
None of us ever heard from that organization again. So I don't even know that anything happened from it.
Feels
who knows
like
what it was?
A weird, like, who's who in American high schools where it's like you... It's like they would audition people and then go, okay, so if you want to be in this, it's $1,000, you know, which covers all of the... I mean, it sounds scammy.
I would have gotten in then, wouldn't I have?
I don't know.
There was something they were looking for.
No, but you were really tone deaf, though.
Yeah, I was really, really tone deaf. No, that was the worst of it. I grew up thinking I could not sing, and I had such a fear of singing. And, you know, it wasn't until later that I just decided, like, whatever, I'm just going to sing anyway, but... That was damaging.
Oh my God. This is definitely a child's fragile sense of self really should not be anywhere near the entertainment business.
I agree. It's hard enough. I see what my 6-year old goes through every day anyway. Just learning his way around kindergarten, figuring it all out. Some kids don't want to play with him one day. It crushes him. Doesn't understand it.
And social media does not help that.
No, thankfully I'm not dealing with any of that yet.
Soon, though.
Yeah, I know, right?
You got a couple of years. You got a couple of years below the radar.
I guess so. Yeah, I'm not sure what I'm going to do about the whole phone thing either. You know, people give their kids Like they turn 10 and they give them their own phone so they can know where they are. But
yeah.
Like, shouldn't you just know where they are? I mean, really?
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, Orstein.
You take them to school.
It's a lot of work.
Pick them up.
Yeah.
They're not driving at that point. I don't know.
And then you got to pay attention to them and give a shit. And it's tough.
Like, if you're losing track of your fucking kids, then you have a larger problem.
If you care that much, then just chip your kids like you do your cat. Just like stick a chip behind their neck. They'll never know.
Just like total recall them up the nose?
Yeah. Yeah, just jam. That's right. We could just put it lightly under the skin, but we're going to jam a probe in your sinus cavity.
I had nightmares after seeing that scene.
Oh, is that? And if you watch now, the effects are just okay.
I know.
Where it's like they've attached the where he's got this like like it's the weird rubber head
when he falls down on Mars with the lack of oxygen and he's going. I am suffocating. His eyes are ooga.
Yep.
Doing like 1940s cartoon eyes.
Well, Ronnie Cox really gets it the most. Like his eyes just explode out of his head into these like these weird cones.
Don't you miss that, Schwarzenegger?
I miss that era of weird when they discovered that you could take an action star and start putting them in dystopian, not too distant future storylines. That was so up my alley.
I enjoyed that as well.
When I was growing up, so up my alley. And Michael Ironside, who played Richter in that,
mm-hmm.
he was just on the podcast last week. And Kyle and Katie will tell you, he was fucking amazing.
Oh.
Like the sweetest, most eloquent, wonderful.
Oh, now I feel like mine's not going that well.
What? No, it's going fine.
I feel like.
Don't. Kyle's notes
like,
say tone deaf.
I feel like
deaf.
You brought that up to shame me or something.
No, I just wanted you to know what it could be like.
Okay.
If you were Michael Ironside.
Okay.
But you're not. I mean, he's.
I'm more like the three-titted woman.
No, she was awesome. What are you talking about? The three-titted woman was rad.
That's all I got.
No, I don't have anything either. What about the guy with the crazy hand, the cab driver?
I enjoy that. Honestly, that movie is one of those, you know, at Family Guy, we all knew Star Wars backwards and forwards. We all could quote blah, 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 blah. But Total Recall, that was like a subset of the set there.
That's right.
That we were very drawn to that.
You film. Have to, it's a very specific film. I mean, like people do know it. I didn't see the remake.
I did not either. I couldn't bring
you
myself
can't.
To do it. I couldn't do it.
You can't do that.
I can't. I don't think I'm going to be able to see Annie either.
It's going to be hard. Yeah, because I, you know, weirdly, I don't know why, when I was a kid, I just loved comedy and sci-fi, but for some reason, I watched Annie a lot, and I don't know why.
Because it was probably like she was your age, maybe?
Yeah, I guess
you know,
so.
It's like your contemporary up there doing a little business on the screen?
I guess so. Didn't we have a long rant once, Kyle, about Daddy Warbucks basically being like a robber baron?
We sure did.
And that there's no way that he was not just an evil industrialist.
Oh, yeah. And a Nazi sympathizer, I think. Oh, yeah.
The yeah. man has war in his name.
Oh, yeah. He was right up there with Ford. He was a good businessman. But yeah. Not
so,
a good guy.
So how does
so let's leave a child in his care.
Yeah, and not only that, let's assume that, you know, Annie starts to, it'd be fun to check in with Annie like in the 50s.
Yeah, it would, right?
Where she's like, she's starting to, does she take over the company? And what does she do with it? And does she basically learn, you know, how to be evil?
Does she become Ann Coulter?
Yeah. Yeah.
These are all good questions.
I think it'd be.
Ann Coulter is a grown up Annie.
Annie.
Guys.
Annie.
Guys.
It's right there. You guys.
I would break into song, but I don't know if you can afford it.
No, we can. You can.
Yeah. We just connected the dots.
That's a pretty incredible connection point right
Weird.
There. But I really love that. But so, yeah, the reboots really have to stop.
I think it's hard. I think any of the reboots probably stand on their own just fine. Someone seeing it, a kid now. Just anything that's, for me, held such an important spot in my childhood, it's hard to... hard to open up to a new version.
And then that's when you start sounding like an old person. You're like, you kids don't understand the original. And they're like, we don't give a shit.
I try not to crap on it, though. If my kid wants to see it, we'll see it.
Yeah.
But I try not to be too curmudgeon-y.
Then you're probably going to watch the reboot of Annie then.
I probably will.
Maybe it's delightful.
Yeah, we'll see.
I'm sure. Although it's sort of hard to top, like, Carol Burnett.
Albert Finney, and Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Tim Curry.
Bernadette Peters.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
That's pretty good.
I think so, too.
Bernadette
Peters.
Who did you identify with the most when you were growing up? Which performers did you identify with?
I used to pray that I was adopted and my real parents were Gilda Radner and Steve Martin.
Oh, of course.
I was in love with both of them. And memorized all their material, but I love Madeline Kahn too, and Peter Sellers. Those were kind of the big ones. I never really liked anyone that was young or new, or you know what I mean. I always kind of liked people that were at a much.
Yeah, me too. And Madeline and Gilda both snuffed out entire like decades before.
I mean, I also, like Barbara Streisand, I also, you know, funny girl, and she was definitely someone that didn't look the way other people were forced to look in most movies, and so I kind of related to that, and there was something.
And she also didn't talk the way most people talked in those movies.
No.
It was a good, like, she was funny. She was genuinely funny.
Really funny. Still is. Really funny, really great timing, smart, perfectionist. I kind of. Those were, I think, the greatest hits.
And at a certain point, did you start to feel like, oh, I think I'm actually a comedy person that other people are watching, as opposed to just you being a kid? It's like, at what point do you stop being the kid that you were in your head, you know? And like, I don't know if at any point if...
Never, I guess.
No, never?
I'm staring at you blankly. I don't know. I mean... It still feels like you're just kind of making things up as you go along. Don't really know what you're doing and are still that kid. Does that answer the question?
It does, but then also at a certain point, you know, as a parent, you do have to kind of like, no, I know how this stuff works, even though you have to fake it sometimes, right?
Absolutely. All the time. All the time. You know, you're making up rules as a parent constantly that make no sense and each one contradicts the last one you just made. We get in the car. Can I watch Word World or whatever the hell it is in the car? You know, there's little screens. No, we're just doing a quick trip. We don't need to watch anything. We can talk. We can do anything. You know, then get in the same trip going back from school. Can we watch? Okay. Sure. I turn it on. You know, I'm incredibly inconsistent and, Whatever works best for everyone in the situation. So that's the number one rule they say with your kids. You have to provide consistency. So I guess I'm failing miserably.
Or you're just consistently inconsistent with them.
There you go.
It's like that actually is working.
Thank you. I feel better. I don't know. Yeah, if my kids got into doing this or being, you know, I see my son enjoys. He sees if I make people laugh, and he enjoys trying to do that himself. You know, he came to the set at Getting On, and we were filming this scene with a small animal.
Okay.
I will say that to not give anything away. And, you know, he watched me just have to do this take, this reaction to the animal, and that's all I did. There was no words. I just leaned my head into frame and had to make a face, and he was by the monitor with the producers and people watching, and everybody broke into laughter after I did it. And that was the first real shocker form of, like, this is so weird. This is what you do. You make funny faces and do weird things and try to get people to laugh. And you see him try to emulate that, you know? It's interesting.
Yeah, and you got to be careful, too, because I would imagine anything you say in front of your kids, just any offhanded comment could all of a sudden be cemented with them as, like, this is law.
Yeah. It's I have a real hard time, like, curbing my language, too. I try really hard. but it slips, especially if I'm upset or angry or scared, or if one of them almost falls, I can't help it. I always cuss.
Yeah.
Which I love that word, cuss.
It's so southern.
It's cuss. But then they repeat it and tell you for the next 4 hours, you said the S word. I know I did. I apologize. You said it. I know I did. But I heard you say it. I know I said it. I'm sorry. Mommy was very scared. Mommy didn't mean to. I apologize.
I heard my dad use the term jerk off once, not just in relation to anything that he was doing, but just like he called someone a jerk off in traffic or something. And I was probably like, I don't know, maybe like kindergarten probably. And I was in a carpool, and then they were dropping me off, and I dropped my bag and I uttered this phrase. And so the other parents are behind me and my mom's in front of me. And so everyone's just present for it. And I just see the look of utter horror on my mom's face because I do remember the feeling of, I'm using grown-up words. I had no idea what it meant.
You say it in reference, like the bag drop, and you went, jerk off bag?
Exactly. It was like, you jerk off. Like, it was sort of, like, I must have sounded like a construction worker in kindergarten. And so to me, it was just like, that's the thing you say, like that rule had.
Yeah.
And so my parents, I feel like what happens a lot, I assume, with parenting is you're trying to explain to a child who is using very basic logic. You said this in a situation, therefore transitively. Mm-hmm. And it's just the parents explaining a lot of exceptions to the rule. Well, yes.
But you don't want to do that at school. Why not? Because it's not appropriate. What does appropriate mean? Fuck. You said fuck.
I know. Like,
it's a lot of that.
improv is yes and, but I feel like parenting is yes but.
Yeah, it's yes a lot but. There's a lot of that. One of my favorites, though, was, you know, you can try to get them off track and fool them sometimes, which is awesome. So we were driving, and I called someone a douchebag. And he was like, what's a douchebag? I said, no, I said juice bag.
Nice.
So now he will say that. Oh, that guy's being a real juice bag. And I laugh so hard, and he's pleased because he thinks he's doing it. And a juice bag. I love it.
It's going to bring a lot of confusion if he's in the wrong aisle at
I know,
the drugstore
right?
and buys the wrong thing.
Hey, they're all fluids.
I mean, you know.
I have to imagine a Capri Sun could clean down there just as well.
Or a treetop apple juice box.
Yeah.
Either way.
Just getting the straw in's tougher, that's all. It's all the same. Natural cleansing agent.
So that's the other thing, is if you could take a Capri Sun commercial but have it be about a douche.
I love it.
Just that same kind of like ban-a-na-bear, like guitar riffs and,
well, it could just be kind of like, my kids work hard all day playing and I work hard all day working, and sometimes we both lose some steam and feel not so fresh. Well, now there's new Capri Sun douche juice. Handles both.
Tropical spring break scent.
Comes with a straw or a little hose.
Now, so this is a little, it's actually not off topic at all. If douching is so bad for people, why is it still something that is available?
I think should a woman find herself post-infection, mm-hmm. post something, someone nasty that's been down there or something, yeah. maybe it's a nice feeling.
Okay.
Or post something awful or traumatic. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Like, it might be a nice feeling to feel like you can take that step and do that. But I think under normal circumstances, it's a self-cleaning organ.
Yeah, and that you should just let it be.
Let it ride. I mean, bathe, ladies. Go ahead and bathe. But soap is fine. But yeah.
But maybe don't.
Pass.
I like that douche has really just become... I remember the transition of douche into the vernacular. I remember a period where douche...
You remember
was,
the day it happened?
I remember the first time someone said it to me, and then all of a sudden, it was just part of the vernacular.
I like it. It's a good word, especially if you're writing for television, network television, and you're very limited.
Can you say douche on television?
I think you can't. You know, depends on the time something airs. Family Guy, for instance, we
right.
can say douchebag. sometimes it's just so nice because you feel like you're actually saying something that has some meat to it.
Right.
Although you never know, like with Family Guy, freaking sweet became this huge, you know, I don't know, catchphrase or whatever for the first 5 years of the show because we couldn't say fucking sweet or we couldn't say fucking and everything was freaking.
Right. Are you weirded out that there are like porn versions online of Family Guy?
You know, I don't care. The only time it ever gets slightly uncomfortable is anytime I go to do morning radio, the DJs like to point it out and show it to me.
Well, they show it to you.
They're like, have you seen this? Click. They've got it all, you know.
I know, but a lot of them are slowly dying inside. And a lot of them are just husks of their former selves.
I think it's interesting. I think it's a little sad, the amount of time people have and what they choose to creatively do with it. But but Lois looks good. I mean, you know, it's not unflattering in any way to me. It's not a actual screen grab of me, so I don't know.
Do you take her personally at this point, or is she still like, yeah, she's a character? Like, how much do you connect with, like, when you're locked into a character, how much do you connect with it as part of yourself?
I try to be protective of her in some ways. There's, when I was there and in the room a lot, it was, you know, it was so natural just to be able to pitch in her voice and say, oh, well, yeah, well, you're a real douchebag, or whatever it was, and then, you know, it could go, you know, not being able to be there to kind of protect the language she gets to use sometimes is a drag. But if there's something I hate in the booth, I'll say, come on, she'd say this. This goes kind of goes against everything we've done, you know. But I definitely, there's times where she ends up having to be more of a wet blanket than I'd like her to be.
Do you riff much in the booth, or is it like this is pretty much?
Every once in a while, but pretty much it's because I know. Sometimes we'll do a take of something where I goof around with it, but they've spent, you know, every episode takes 9 months to make.
Right.
Every script is broken, the idea is broken, then someone takes it away and does an outline, and then there's notes on the outline, and then they sometimes redo it, or they go straight to script. Then after the script comes in, they tear it apart, rewrite it for days, sometimes weeks. We have a table read, tear it apart after the table, rewrite it again from there. So knowing what goes into it before you're recording it, you're kind of a douchebag if you're saying, I think I know better.
So you guys don't, you can't, it would be impossible for you guys to record as a group.
We used to. In the beginning, we tried doing it like a radio play, and it was really fun, but really ineffective. And now, with everyone's schedules, it's like Mila's a movie star. Seth Green has 40 shows. McFarlane is directing Ted 2. Before that, A Million Ways to Die. I'm doing Getting On. And so it's impossible with schedules to try to.
Everyone's doing really well.
Knock on wood, baby. It's pretty rare.
Is Family Guy just picked up forever? Like, is it just one of those shows where it's like, oh yeah, it's just like it just goes and goes and goes and goes?
I hope so. I mean, y'all heard my furniture story. Seth and everyone is, you know, Steve Callahan at the helm, and he's doing it with Rich Appel. He's show running and. Every writer in the room wants to do it so long as it's funny. And if they're still, it sounds hokey, but every table read, we're still laughing out loud genuinely. And everyone kind of feels like so long as that keeps happening, we'll keep wanting the show on the air. And Seth does not want it to just get super shitty and go out that way.
Right.
But so long as I think the quality maintains the level that it's at, I think these new scripts are really fucking funny. So I think we're in good shape.
If you guys want to do it, we should do like a Family Guy episode of At Midnight. I think that'd be really fun to have you guys on panel.
Have everybody on?
Well, just three of you, and then walk-ons like for people, because only three people play at a time. But
fun. I meant stack it with
it with everyone, like with people from the show.
That's funny.
I think it'd be really fun.
If people would do it. Schedule-wise, again,
of
like
course.
That's the thing. We want to do another. We would do the Family Guy live shows where we go around and we do a live reading, and then we sing a bunch of the songs from the show and do a lot of really filthy versions of things that could never make it to air. And we want to do another one of those. We keep talking about London, but we can't.
What's an example of a really filthy thing that might not make it?
Oh well.
I mean, what did you guys do?
We would sing filthy versions of songs. That I shouldn't. I don't want to give that away, right? If we do the show again, it kind of blows it, doesn't it?
But just like a nugget to tempt people into writing their congressman to have it be the state play.
What could I share? What could I share that wouldn't happen again? No, there's nothing. There's nothing I could share that won't ruin it.
So if people want to see it, they should go see it live, provided that all of your schedules work.
Yeah.
And this actually does pan out at some point.
Yes. I mean, we also do, there's some like scenes that were, the way that the live shows first started, the first one we did was the show that they didn't want to air called When You Wish Upon a Weinstein. Mm-hmm. And it was, they were too scared to do it because they thought it was slamming Jewish people and they were afraid that it was too anti-Semitic. And then another one that we did was Partial Terms of Endearment. Uh-huh. That was like an abortion-themed episode. And so a lot of those were kind of developed thinking, we'll just do these for the live shows and then DVDs and stuff like that. So there are things like that.
How many times a week do people ask you to leave their outgoing message on their phone?
Quite a few. A lot. A lot. And now I do it as an auction item. Like, so if at charity events, like I'm involved with the National Hemophilia Foundation, or if someone else says, oh, can you donate something? I'll say, I'll do a voice message or something like that. Cause then it kind of works. You get like the people who most people that stop you on the street and want something from you aren't even big fans.
They just want to see if they can control you like a puppet?
They're just shit collectors. They're the type of people that take chocolates from the hotel. You know, the maid cart is there, and they grab another fucking shampoo. They never use it at home. It's just, they're just shit takers. And
right.
That's what I find. Most people are like, oh, can I get a picture with you, man? Oh, yeah. And they're never going to look at it. They don't care. They don't know your name. So I feel like then you kind of – someone's going to bid on that at an auction. It's worth everyone's
time.
We're super excited about it.
And it's for a good cause.
Yeah, it's kind of nice.
That's good. So as we're wrapping down, is there anything you want to tell people about Getting On for anyone who hasn't seen the show? What's your pitch to people for watching the show?
Oh, shit. Getting On. Let's see. Getting On is a television program on HBO. I'm describing it. Television is a way of getting entertainment into your home.
But it's not TV, Alex. It's HBO.
That's so true.
Yeah.
You can watch these things alone or with friends.
With friends?
How am I doing?
It's good so far.
It's a show with Laurie Metcalf, Niecy Nash, and me, and Mel Rodriguez, and we play nurses and a doctor in a very run-down geriatric wing, all-female geriatric wing of a hospital in Long Beach, a fictional hospital in Long Beach, which sounds so depressing, but I don't know how, but somehow it's really funny, but it has a lot of really touching moments. It's a lot of people don't want to, a lot of people say it sounds depressing and it's something I don't want to look at. And I kind of say it's almost like a car wreck. Mm-hmm. It's highly entertaining. You can't take your eyes off of it. It's tragic. It kind of has you shocked in some moments, touched in others, and laughing. I don't know. It hits a tone that I haven't seen before in a lot of TV shows. And it's one of my favorite things about doing it is each script, you're kind of on a roller coaster of things that you're getting to do.
Well, I'm glad that you're working. I mean, it sounds like you're working on a bunch of fun stuff that you like doing. And I think that's the most that you can ask for in the business.
In any business. This is so rare. I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky to be doing this. It's to have Family Guy, and I am the luckiest woman in baseball.
This is not baseball.
What?
You're not playing baseball anymore.
No, it is. It's so rare to get. I get the material handed to me. I read the script and I'll go on to do a scene in the show and get it wrong like 80% of the time. And I'm not seeing like 14 other layers that are there. And it's just really rich. And it's not so much what's there on the page. It's also what's not there. So you're left struggling to figure it out on the set. And I think that's what makes the most interesting moments on the show, that it's so uncomfortable. The audience doesn't know how to feel. It's because we don't know how to feel. And you can kind of see it on everyone's faces.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the ways when comedy is working at its best is when it's forcing people to sort of face something uncomfortable but very human.
Yeah.
And be able to sort of to be able to extract. I mean, it's not that you're laughing at humanity and how ridiculous
And death, I mean, we're all going to die. Everyone's got a mom, and this show is moms dying. I mean, this is the hardest thing there is. And for me, when I lost my grandmother, it was so hard. And there's so many moments on the show that bring me back to the, it was awful, it was dark, but it was also hilarious. Like, my grandmother kept telling when I would show up to visit her, she'd say, "There is a man in the night who is dancing with me." And I was like, "What are you talking about? No one's dancing with you, Grandma. What? Somebody is dancing with me." And it was this giant black male nurse that would pick her up so they could change the bedding and change the sheets. But it was whole, like, she was convinced this dude's making a pass every night. He's picking me up and dancing with me. And some morning she loved it. It was like, I danced. I was dancing all night. And it was, it was heartbreaking, but hilarious and warm. And, you know, her teeth were missing. Many, we didn't, teeth weren't by the bedside in the morning, and we'd be on a hunt for her teeth. And what the hell did she do with them? You know, it was, and the show just really captured it. The two showrunners dealt with their mom's slow deaths, and so it's written from a real place and real heart. And
I think that's important. You know, I think it's important to be able to, I mean, because I think it, it gives you at least what little, even if it's an illusion, just a little bit of power, a feeling like we have a power over something by being able to point and go, this is fucking horrible, so we have to make fun of it, because if we don't, we'll just kill ourselves now.
I think so. I mean, that's, isn't that why we all got into comedy?
I think so. Oh, I think also a broken need for attention.
Right.
Also that, that, that too.
There's that.
There's that too, but I like the altruistic approach as well.
I don't know. We're making lemonade.
Out of lemons.
I think, I don't know. I think if you don't force yourself to look at the stuff that's difficult to watch, you're going to miss some amazing stuff that's mixed in there.
Well, as we're wrapping up, I'm sorry that you don't know the name of the woman who wrote Tone Deaf on your piano sheet, so we couldn't track her down on Facebook. And
that would be awesome. Anyone out there knows Kids of the Century? Let me know.
What, did you look it up? Katie's looking it up right now. Kids of the Century.
Kids of the Century.
Just find all those people were arrested.
About 86?
Would you?
It's a song from some German metal band.
Was it a German metal production?
It was not.
Okay. Because in that case, Tone Deaf would probably be a compliment.
That's right.
And maybe that's like, oh, she's a perfect.
And maybe it was like Tonandef.
Tonandef is good.
It's a whole other word.
She's good.
It means exquisite.
Needs to be able to howl in German.
Nothing. Yeah, it was probably.
I'm always disappointed when things somehow just miss the internet. Like, no, everything's on the internet. It's a sum total of human knowledge.
I bet what it was they were looking for kids to do. They were trying to make a pilot TV show. I bet that's, it was for a pilot show or something that never happened or something.
All right, Kids of the Century is the internet's mission to find that and post it on the podcast page, and then we can see if we can track this person down.
And you'll let me know?
Yeah, so you can go just beat the shit out of this woman who's probably very frail now.
I can get the Nerdist app, and it will alert when you've discovered the information.
That's right. Yeah, okay. it'll let you know. It's basically helps you seek revenge for childhood wrongings.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah,
that's actually a great idea for an app.
It gives you all the info for anyone who bullied you when you were younger, so you can. Because then you look at him now and you're like, ah, that guy turned out shitty.
it's just called the Bully Finder.
Bully Finder. Bully Finder. Yeah,
I love it.
Every person who like knocked you down, you're like, guy's got no hair. Big old tub of shit now.
I'm going to start working on that immediately.
We're going to make this happen. Alex Borstein, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Enjoy your breed, everyone. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Girls Fight Back is the world-renowned personal safety and empowerment-based self-defense company that teaches women and people of all gender identities how to live confidently while being their own best protector. As a leading voice on violence prevention and empowerment for over 20 years, Girls Fight Back has trained over 1 million people around the world since 2001.
Their engaging workshops create a safe environment for groups to learn evidence-backed, life-saving skills, emphasizing that self-defense education is about more than just physical resistance. Girls Fight Back, led by CEO Nicole Snell, provides audiences with a range of applicable safety strategies that can be used in any setting so that you can lead a badass life.
To learn more about Girls Fight Back and to bring their award-winning trainings and seminars to your community, visit girlsfightback.com. That's girlsfightback.com.